raise your hands all up in the air.
Video Game Warriors, we are back from the battlefield, and we are here today with our very special guest, Mr. Blake J. Harris, author of Console Wars, a book that you can buy. It's in stores. You can get it digitally on Amazon and Kindle and all those other digital formats, and it's soon to be two feature films, correct?
Yeah, a documentary and a dramatization.
If I get anything wrong about your book, you're welcome. You're so close, you're welcome to just backhand me.
I've been preparing. Last night I was like...
You hit me over the head with your hat.
I'm ready to rock.
Well, hit a guy with the glasses.
We appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. I met Greg like a year and a half ago at a book signing at a retro game store in New York, and we hit it off. I've always been a Greg fan, so thanks for having me, guys.
You've always been a Greg fan?
Yeah.
Greg does sign autographs at those game conventions. So.
Never the same way twice. You cannot forge my autograph. It is never the same autograph twice.
But it kills the eBay sales. It just makes it really difficult. Bad.
I think you're also friends with the author of the We Don't Need Roads.
Yes! Cassin Gaines.
Yeah, Cassin Gaines. That is my friend. He wrote a good behind-the-scenes look at Back to the Future, and I met up with him. And
really? Oh, yes, right. I forgot that, yeah.
So you're a connector of... Yeah. People. So
I'm like the New York area geeky book author.
Yeah, today we're going to be having a retrospective on all of the famous people that Greg knows, which, my God, will be here for hours.
Well, that's... I mean, just seeing in passing is one thing, but actually knowing is not that many.
So, Mr. Harris, let's get right to it.
All right, let's dive
in. The console wars. The bloody battles were fought. Right, give our listeners, all 10 of them, the cliff notes, the bullet points on what the console wars were.
So back in the day, 1989, Nintendo was the king of the video game world. To say that they were the market leader is a gross understatement. They were video games. They literally took out ads to say that there's no such thing as a Nintendo for trademark purposes because Nintendo was becoming so synonymous with video games, like jacuzzis with hot tubs and Kleenexes with tissues. And so Sega came into the market, as did NEC with the TurboGrafx in 1989, and they both kind of thought, all right, well, you know, Sega failed with the Master System, their 8-bit system, compared to Nintendo's 8-bit NES, and they thought, you know, we can't win that battle, so let's change the location of the battle to better hardware. 16 bits, in theory, it would seem to be twice as good and twice as popular, but it was not very successful even when it came out. And it took a couple of years to catch on, which is very strange because, you know, we think nowadays when a new console or when anything new comes out, we're all excited and either succeeds or fails. But it was strange that the Genesis came out in the fall of 89, and then it took a couple of years to really catch on. And part of that was because there was a changing of the guard over there, and Tom Kalinske joined, and a lot of other folks at Sega, and also Sonic the Hedgehog. They needed somebody who was not Alex Kidd to take on Mario. And so in the course of the next 3 years, Sega went from 5% of the market up to 55% of the market, and we were all soldiers on the front lines of that battle, and it was just a really exciting time.
Despite Alex Kidd's fantastic sideburns, he turned out to not... be the mascot for Sega. They did move to Sonic as their guy.
Well, I don't know about you guys, but I was sort of like the Swiss, where I was somewhat neutral because I had both systems.
Mm. How did you... Wait, like you had like a Super Nintendo? And a,
yes.
How?
Well,
that was like such an anomaly.
I've told this story before. Basically, it was that I had the NES, obviously. I had that for several years. And then the Genesis came out, and I really wasn't familiar with it. A lot of people that I knew didn't have it yet. And then I saw John Madden Football, which was around, it was probably like 90, 91. I was like, this is amazing. This kills Nintendo. I must have this. So I think 91 I got it for like Christmas or something like that, my birthday. It was the Sonic version, you know, Sonic on the box. And I had that. And then, you know, what would happen to be is, you know, just as kids, I think I was in junior high then, you know, some friends would be, were still Nintendo stalwarts, and other people were now Sega, you know, aficionados, and it was a war. You know, it was like, nah, that, you know, look at this game on the Genesis compared to Super Nintendo. I couldn't tell the difference, but basically what happened was I went into a Toys R Us. After hearing all this talk forever, ever, SNES came out. I went into a Toys R Us, and they had Super Mario Kart on the demo, on a kiosk. And I played that, and I would, I'd go to the Toys R Us just to play that for, like, a month.
The Toys R Us managers had to kick him out. They'd be closing up shop.
I would kick the little kids as they came near me to try and play. Get out of here! And I was like, I gotta have this somehow. How do I get this? Thankfully, I had a sister and who was younger than me, and she was more into, and this is, I guess, sort of, you know, how Nintendo is still today. She was still more into the Mario games. Like, she liked the Kirby games when it came out. You know, kind of the goofy games. And so she wanted, like, you could still get them for NES, but I kind of said that, hey, if we get this, this will be for both of us. So that's what we did. And so the SNES...
And part of what made me want to write the book, or like why the subject matter had such a strong devotion to me, was it really felt like political parties for kids. It was like you were on one side or the other, and then that oriented your entire worldview. And I remember at times thinking, like, I'm not right in this argument, but, like, I have to fight for it because I'm, like, a Sega guy, and that's what I say. So, like, no, your version sucks, or, you know, but that was how it was. And
it was like Reebok and Nike. I remember then there was, like, a Reebok-Nike thing.
Yeah.
It's like if you had the one sneakers, the other guys had the other sneakers, and there was, like, there was some animosity there.
So, Blake, you mentioned just now that you were a Sega guy.
Mm.
So how did that come about?
Good question. Because I didn't want to be at first. Because, like you, like probably like you too as well, and like one in three homes in America, I had an 8-bit NES. I got it for Christmas in 88 or 89. It was, at the time, maybe even in my entire life, the best gift I ever got. My brother and I played it. So many of my stories about playing early video games start with Wii, because I just, it was like the one thing we did together. I had a younger brother who I didn't really like because he was so much nicer than me. But that was like the one thing I needed him for player two, or there to like give me an audience. And so, you know, younger we loved brothers. The NES. So of course the we wanted this Super Nintendo. Yes. But the sad thing was I was like the Luigi because he was so much better than me.
You always need the brother or the sister. No matter how good you are, there's always that one nuance of one level that you can't get past, and you hand them the controller, and even just by dumb luck, like, they can
but then they won't give it back.
Yeah. So, I remember, so, coming up for, like, Hanukkah in 1991, which was the year that Super Nintendo had come out that fall, like, my brother and I basically prepared, like, the childhood equivalent of, like, a PowerPoint presentation of, like, hey, Mom and Dad, like, here's why we definitely need to combine our gifts together, and this is, like, what we have to get the Super Nintendo.
Did you cut out pictures from the Sears catalog and tape them to poster board?
Probably. And so, and my parent, and I very distinctly remember my father saying, no, I'm not going to get you the Super Nintendo, because then Nintendo's going to come out with the Super Duper Nintendo, and the Super Super Duper Nintendo. And he was, I guess, correct, if you take the long view of history. But, like,
Super Duper Nintendo.
I would have, you know, I've been known on this podcast Nintendo. For saying how much I hate the Nintendo 64. If it was called the Super Duper Nintendo, I would be on board.
Yeah.
I would be a card carrying, flag waving.
But, like, you know, and so looking back and part of my beginning of writing this book, thinking, like, why did my father not get us this thing that we wanted so badly? My parents were, they didn't spoil us, but if there was one thing we wanted and that was the only thing we wanted, we were willing to work together, usually they would find a way to get it for us. You know, they were really good parents. And so looking back, what it was my parents didn't like the fact, like a lot of parents, that the Super Nintendo was not backwardly compatible.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, sort of leading to the genesis of this book, it was like, a business decision in a boardroom somewhere where the Nintendo decided, all right, it's not worth the extra $70, or we don't, you know, it's not worth us crafting it in this way. Somehow I went from Team Nintendo to Team Sega, and like the rest was history. And so I kind of was curious about what other decisions like that were made, like where did Sonic come from, what happened to Sega, what happened to Nintendo.
Boy, for, you know, not to speak ill of your family, your parents sound like wonderful people, but for them to have made a business decision essentially saying, we don't want to get the Nintendo because we're concerned that they're going to come out with one new system in a short period of time, and they bought Sega. Nah.
No, but it was like Sega was an exception. It was like this other thing.
It was. But then they had the 32X and the Sega CD and the Saturn and every... Yeah. Like,
no, of course.
Sega gave us the most rapid succession of hardware escalation that we think we've probably ever seen in the history of
consoles.
Here's
the other thing, though, that when you think about Nintendo's decision to not have the backwards compatibility in SNES to NES, think about it. That, in and of itself, from that decision, you have Funko Land. And from Funko Land, you have GameStop.
Yeah,
and everything else. I mean, you literally.
Correct.
They would never have. I mean, they probably would have existed because new systems, you know, were coming out. But I mean,
I cut my teeth managing a Funko Land.
It sort of standardized the system of updates that weren't backwards compatible.
Right, but it gave you a reason. It wasn't just like, okay, like today, if you know Xbox or PS4 comes out with a new game and you play it for 2 weeks and you say, oh, I'm done with this game, I want to get another game. That wasn't enough of a business. It was the fact that people would buy this Super Nintendo for their kids, and they had all these NES games, which, I mean, they could have still played them, but still, you know, like, parents are like, the kids aren't going to play with this old thing
anymore.
Well,
the funny thing is, like, because
nowadays,
I think everyone is pretty comfortable with and familiar with the television and, like, the inputs, and we all have, like, a DVD player, a Blu-ray player, and we switched to HDMI. Back then, like, people were petrified of that. I knew how to use, like, the
My parents still are.
Yeah. And so, like, when you think of... You could actually still have the Nintendo and the Super Nintendo next to each other, and all you had to do was just toggle which one was plugged in. Like, sure. It wasn't like you were committing to one.
There's a daisy chain, the RF adapter.
Yeah.
So I can recall...
It was just, like, a different time.
The Nintendo, when I had bought... My parents had already... Unlike yours, my parents had checked out on buying me video game consoles after the ColecoVision. So I'm going back, like... A few years earlier, to about 85, when they bought an Atari, they really enjoyed that. That's where my love of console gaming comes from. And then they said, look at this thing, the ColecoVision. It's bigger, it's better, it's got a much better version of Donkey Kong. It's got, you know, all of these add-ons. You can get a steering wheel and a thing. We can play the 2600 games. And they invested a lot in the Coleco. And then the market crash happened. The games market crash happened. Mm-hmm. And they were like, all right, that's it, we're done. By the time Nintendo had rolled around, I had similarly said, I want one. And they said, well, if you want one, you figure out a way to earn enough money to get one. So Nintendo was my first thing that I personally purchased.
So how did you earn the money?
I talked about this on the podcast one time. We had a Nintendo... Yeah, I'm not proud of those days, and it'll keep me from ever running for political office. But I actually shoveled snow one winter in Jersey with a close friend of mine, and we co-purchased the Nintendo ourselves.
Oh no!
What?
And it was like an episode of a 1980s sitcom.
Yeah,
that was the Simpsons episode. It was Radioactive Man.
I swear it literally happened in my life. It predated the Simpsons episode by about, you know, 10 years or however long it was. And I had it for 2 weeks out of the month, and he had it for 2 weeks out of the month.
This couldn't have ended.
And it didn't end particularly well for our friendships or for, you know, our wallets. I eventually bought it out. I was the one who finally broke down and said, like, I have to buy out my half of this. And
that's amazing. I feel like it should have come with a game and a laugh track so that you'd have, like, your 80s sitcom experience.
It was. It was literally like living an 80s sitcom. But the point of my convoluted story is that it was the first device I recall ever having to use composite inputs on the back of my parents' television. And to them, those red, yellow, and white, like, plugs were a mystery. Like, we don't have any kind of electronic components that go into those. And I had the Nintendo,
you're
and I'm like,
break it. Don't put
there. Exactly. Like, they were like, are you sure that's not going to, like, blow out the television? I'm like, no, it'll be fine, and that way you won't have to unplug your VCR to get your to get my game to work, and it worked, and that was
still something that even I would, between myself and my sister, we would fight in that if you wanted to play a game, there was just the one spare. We had like the living room television, and we had like this other old television in the spare room, and we would fight over that, and you know who would play it. And that was just a typical thing.
Yeah.
So a lot of, that's why, again, why systems that, and I'm sure this is the case later on, like, I know Frankie hates it, but the N64, one of its biggest selling points was the multiplayer aspect. And that's why, because now, yeah, fight over it, but you're playing the same game.
Right.
So you're almost forced, all right, you know, which game do we play? Put that in, and you're almost like a robot. Okay, here's game I must play.
So yeah. I don't hate multiplayer, I just not a fan of the 64's graphics.
Yes.
We all have our stories. Like I was kind of in Greg's situation. I got the Super Nintendo and the Genesis the same year, actually, in 1991.
Wow.
But the thing is, unlike Frankie, I never had a TV that had composite inputs. I was always playing on like these hand-me-downs from like 1984.
So did I.
So what I would do is I had these like state-of-the-art systems, but they would be daisy-chained by RF. So like I'd be playing like Sega CD through RF on this little 13-inch, you know.
So it was not unlike unscrambling those high number channels where if you squint, you can kind of see what was going on. And
but it was
the scramble would
scramble.
The scramble.
You know what's on the scramble channel.
But you know, getting back to your book, my curiosity is what inspired you to write it though in the first place.
So what happened was, my brother and I, we had a Sega Genesis growing up. I hadn't played it for 20-something years. You know, we ended up getting an N64 and actually a PlayStation as well. And so we kind of put aside our Genesis, and then almost four and a half years ago for my birthday, my brother got me a Sega Genesis again, because he was saying, you know, what was the best gift you ever got? He wanted to get me a good gift, and I was like, well, I think that, you know, the Genesis was one of the really good things we got. And so I booted it up. I played some NHL 94, and I really enjoyed playing it. It brought back a lot of memories. And then after memories, now I'm 32, but I guess I was 28 or so then, like as a kind of adult, I was thinking like, you know, what was going on behind the scenes? Why did I end up with Genesis? And I had a lot of questions, especially like, also like what happened to Sega? I mean, I knew that they were kind of still around as a software maker, but like how come they weren't in the hardware business, and how come Nintendo seemed to be such a distant third? So I had a lot of questions, and I went to the Barnes & Noble on 86th Street in Manhattan, which was near where I lived at the time, and I was looking for the video game history section next to the film history section and the music history section. No such section existed.
Yeah.
Not yet.
Yeah, and so I went up to the information desk, and I said, like, oh, hey, you know, she laughed at me when I asked where the video game history section was, and I was like, well, you know, can I just get one of the books about Sega or Nintendo or, like, something, video game history, business of video games, something? And they didn't have anything in the entire store. They didn't even have anything that they could order for me, which is always what they try to sell me when I'm like, yeah, I can go on Amazon myself, don't worry. I was like, so in the entire store, the only thing you have with video games is walkthrough guides? And she's like, yeah, we have walkthrough guides. And I said, like, that's weird. For an industry that is bigger than film and music combined, and also has this nostalgic value, and also has this cultural entertainment value, that they didn't have a single, like, mainstream book. And of course, you know, once I began to research this, and after that moment, thought, like, well, there's got to be stuff out there if it's just on the internet. And I found David Sheff's book and Stephen Kent's book and Leonard Herman's book and other things that were out there. But, you know, the one that was closest to the kinds of stories I like to read, which are behind-the-scenes business stories, like The Smartest Guys in the Room or Disney War or anything like that, was Game Over by David Sheff, which is a really great book. And so I'm reading it, and it's talking about how Nintendo resurrected the industry after that game crash that you referred to. And, like, you know, they have Mario, they have Zelda, they have everything. They have some heavy-handed business tactics. They don't want a repeat of the crash. They're kind of jerks, or they're kind of, you know, just these game development gurus that have this philosophy of only making good games and they're hard on other companies. And so it gets to the end of the book, and it's like, oh, this scrappy company Sega's on the scene, and they have Sonic, but Nintendo beat them, and, like, you know, who knows what the future will bring? There's this thing called the World Wide Web and multimedia. And it was like, basically, like, up to, like, around 92. I think it was written, it was published in 93, and it was like, I felt like it was just getting to the good part of the story. And that was when it cut out. And so, in a lot of ways, I thought of Console Wars as, like, the spiritual successor to that. And, of course, you know, the book starts a little bit before the end of 92. It starts in 1990. But it's just sort of that story that David's telling from the perspective of Sega for a lot of it, and also just seeing what happened next and how we went from video games being these things that you would typically buy in a Toys R Us and that to now it's big, you know, you buy it at a Best Buy, you buy it, it's a mainstream form of entertainment, and a lot of that's because of that war between Sega and Nintendo. So that's kind of how I got into it. And then the other main thing was, and I've spoken to Greg about it a lot, like, the big thing for me was speaking to the people themselves, and making sure that this story was their story, and that it wasn't just parroted history of what else is out there, which I think is a lot of what video game history has become, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And so I ended up interviewing over 200 people, and once I heard, after I spoke with Tom Kalinske, who was the CEO of Sega of America from 1990-96, and Al Nilsson, and then even some people from Nintendo like Gail Tilden and Peter Main, I could see the story through their eyes, and that was what made me want to spend 3 years writing this, because I knew it would be fun, but I also thought it was important that, like, they were also like, yeah, why isn't anyone written this? Why, like, it seems like such a no-brainer. So yeah. I kind of, you know, I feel very lucky that I got to be the one to do it, but it's definitely a story people are interested in, and I'm glad that it's out there now.
So Tom Kalinske was your guy. Like, he... The story follows him the most closely in your book, and I would assume that he provided you with the largest amount of information. What was it like speaking to the people at Nintendo? How many people at Nintendo were even willing to talk about the history? Because Nintendo being a Japanese company, being a guarded company, being a kind of a Disney-esque company, like, they don't want to pull back the curtain, I would assume, on a lot of inner workings.
Absolutely. Getting into the world of Nintendo, speaking to their former employees was the hardest part of researching and writing the book. A lot of that is because of the company's identity, which you described as being very conservative Japanese, very guarded. There's also the fact that because it is a Japanese company and it's one of the ones that really seems to live by that philosophy of once you have a job there for life. So a lot of the employees that were back there, that were working there in the 80s and 90s, were either still there or had left in the past year or so. So it wasn't like Sega or Sony, where it was like more like a Silicon Valley company, where you're in, you're out, you spend a few years there. So it was really hard. And, you know, for a period of time, I would say that like 90-95% of the book was the Sega perspective, not just Tom, but also the other people I spoke with there, because I was able to speak with them. But it was really important to me to try to get the Nintendo perspective. And in the end, it's definitely not a 50-50 split. Part of me wishes that it was, but also part of me thinks that the Nintendo stuff, especially early on, just isn't as exciting. I mean, an underdog story is kind of compelling. But so, like, the short answer to your question is, I got stonewalled from Nintendo corporate. I got turned down a lot from former Nintendo employees for a long period of time. But I had gotten to the point where I knew I sold the book proposal. I knew HarperCollins was publishing it. I knew that Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg were making a feature film based on it. I knew we were doing a documentary. So after 2 years, I basically went to them and said, hey, guys, you know, there's these three things coming out. Yeah. You guys are discussing it a lot. It's almost exclusively from your competitors. So please, you know, keep that in mind, and also understand that, like, I've already sold the book, so I'm asking to do more work to tell your story, when it would just be very easy for me to be like, boom, all right, I got a book, I got the Sega story, so please understand there's, like, a level of respect in me asking you. It's not, I'm not trying to bug you. And so they did start to open up, and I think the documentary was critical in that, because we were able to get Howard Lincoln on camera. They didn't want him to be left out, which I agree. I think the documentary would have been incomplete without Howard. And so, like, in the end, I was able to speak with everybody I wanted to, except for Minoru Arakawa, who is the president of Nintendo of America. I never really imagined I would be able to, because his father-in-law...
Those who don't know, Howard Lincoln was Nintendo's American branch.
He was the number two to Arakawa, but a lot of... they were sort of like the joint leadership. He was actually at one point promoted ahead of Arakawa. He's now currently the CEO of the Seattle Mariners, which is a team that Nintendo owns.
Yeah.
He was infamous, correct me if I'm wrong, he was a lawyer, I believe, but he was infamous for helping Nintendo win the King Kong lawsuit.
Yeah, I loved speaking to Howard, and he's probably my favorite Nintendo interview or favorite Nintendo character, and part of that's because, you know, we all... nobody's perfect. And especially when Nintendo was at the top, they did some things that ruffled the feathers of other people. And Howard understood that. He took pride in it, and he understood why that was done. But a lot of the people at Nintendo thought that... some of the things that I wrote about them, which were factually correct, were like they were wounded by that. You know, the facts are they did go through antitrust litigation with the government. Mm. They did end up settling those things. They did anger third-party developers. They did anger video rental places. And Sega also angered people. But and, you know, they seemed to understand, like, yeah, you know, when you don't get successful without breaking a few eggs. But so I really love that Howard Lincoln almost took pride in that, like, he won the Universal suit and that Nintendo was very litigious. And for me, the big turning point was kind of, you know, when I was speaking mostly with Sega people and had more of a Sega perspective, I kind of thought this was like a good versus evil type story, David and Goliath story. But it really is a story of, like, David versus Goliath, except Goliath was David 5 years earlier. And it was just really, it wasn't a good versus bad. It was two companies with different philosophies. Sega yeah. was very into marketing. They were probably more into style over substance. And Nintendo believed in game development. And they wanted things to be of a certain quality to avoid another crash and a glut of products. And there was at least a philosophy behind some of the heavy-handed decisions they made. So in the end, I was really happy with the support I was able to get from Nintendo. And actually, Sega was not was the one that was not supportive because, you know, if there is a villain in the book, I would say it's probably Sega of Japan.
Yeah,
that
well,
thwarts
sure.
a lot of what
they deserve it.
Yeah, and at times
the
I felt
animosity between the two brands.
Yeah, like I went through a lot of time thinking, like, am I being unfair to Sega of Japan? But the numbers really back it up. Like, in sure. here they did surpass Nintendo, or they were at least equal. Yeah, in Japan, they never really achieved more than 15% of the market. So the fact that they weren't deferring to the more successful brands, or that they were putting barriers in place. So they were really more of the villain in the story. And because I would say that they won, you know, Sega of Japan is run Sega now, and Sega of America, actually, the offices were closed earlier this year.
Yeah.
So that since they're the ones in charge,
well, they're not running much.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Well, they're running things on the ground. Yeah. And so they were not very happy with the book. I heard secondhand that they, like, told employees not to talk about it and not to, like, bring it up and read it. Not that I thought it would be, like, a great big talking point, but, you know, it was also 20 years ago. It was,
really?
Like, one of the greatest compliments I got was from Shinobu Toyota, who was, you know, the number two or number three at Sega of America. He was kind of the liaison between America and Japan. Mm-hmm. I spoke to him a few weeks ago about a new book I'm working on. He currently works for Unity, you know, the game engine mm-hmm.
yes.
company. And he was saying that he does business with Nintendo and that several of the Japanese executives are reading Console Wars and really enjoying it. Mm. And it's because they understand, like, this was 20 years ago. And he said the greatest comment I got was that he said that they now treat him with so much more respect. And I was like, that's great that, like, these people you actually do business with respect you more, because everyone in the story deserves...
He definitely came off as, like, an unsung hero
yeah.
in the book, that he was often tasked with going back to Sega of Japan with these, not demands, but these ideas that Sega of America would have. And,
right.
you know, they were almost, like, giving it to him, like... Like, here, take, like, he was, like, holding radioactive waste, yeah. walking into the wasteland, but...
Like, the messenger to deliver the... deliver.
Yeah. And, like, the unsung hero is a good expression for him, because I feel like a lot of these people are unsung heroes, and part of that is because, as we know, video game history is kind of unsung. But also, I think there's a tendency, when you talk about history, and I'm probably guilty of it myself, it's like, you say a person's name, it's like, oh, what'd they do? Tell me in one sentence what they did. But I think real history and real progress feels a lot more to me like The West Wing, which is one of my favorite TV shows, where it's like, I don't know, did Sam Seaborn come up with this decision? Did CJ? Wasn't it kind of like the dynamic of all of them together? I mean, the president gets the credit and gets the blame, but it's like the way things happen is much more of a team effort, and it's more learning about, like, the culture and the process than just saying, oh, this is the guy who programmed this game.
I think it's a cultural difference in that One of the things that we have, and this is, you know, why your book, I think, is one of the reasons that I read it immediately, and I think a lot of people have enjoyed it, is that it's the first book to really cover this era. And the reason is, there is this, I'm going to say love affair, but there is, like, rose-colored glasses looking back to, like, the Atari era, and which was American, it was all American and all that, it was California, and they look at that, and but Atari wasn't a true business. It was, but it was still wacky.
I mean, yeah. You know,
right.
There wasn't very much structure there, and a lot of what they did, what Atari...
Like, see to their pants, kind
of... Exactly, yeah. But a lot of...
Silicon Valley model of, like, yeah, you know, come to work in flip-flops, do a few lines of coke.
Right.
Maybe program a game.
But you didn't have... Come and go as you please. You didn't have Bill Gates or Steve Jobs guiding the company with a vision. You basically had Atari... Who became huge thanks to the VCS and their arcade games and, you know, all that stuff over a very small period of time, and then they kind of rode that. It was so popular, and as they were driving off the cliff, they were still riding that wave. The wave was just high enough, and so they just kind of lasted as long as they did because they were for a while they were the only game in town, but. When you look at Nintendo, and then when you look at Sega, and especially as your book shows, particularly with Sega, the inner workings, you know, I think as at least for me, as you know, you get older and you're working in a business, you're working in a corporation, corporate identity, you start to relate to that a lot better than Atari, which was all this freewheeling,
right.
You know, craziness. Whereas Sega, I mean, one of my favorite parts of the book is maybe some people think it's too wonky, but I mean, there's so many marketing concepts that you wrote about in there that Sega were trying, you know, from, you know, putting the pop-up store in front of the Walmart headquarters in Arkansas, and a lot of the traveling stuff that they used to have, and on all those marketing ideas that I guess nobody really bothered with before with video games.
Yeah, it's like you said, it's combining the... creative property, the intellectual property, with the business side of things. And I think that's why it not just was it successful, but it's also like there's a reason why in the store we see Sonic things, we see Mario things, we see Mega Man things, and we're not seeing like Pitfall and Pac-Man and these other characters, which are, I know the graphics were different and it's also a different generation, but I do think that there's a reason why Sonic is on t-shirts today and not Crash Bandicoot, which was probably an equally as good game for what it represented to PlayStation. And it's because of the business and the marketing aspects, which, you know, I think also, before getting into this, I kind of thought marketing was just like people trying to sell me things and it was something I didn't want to do with, but I actually realized that, oh, it's starting opening a store defiantly because somebody won't listen to you, and it's kind of coming up with these clever things and in the process kind of skewing up what video games were and making it more mainstream and acceptable to play.
And that was Kalinske's hallmark. I mean, that was what he was known for.
The Barbie
and that's
guy.
Why they brought him in with Mattel, right? It was Mattel.
Yeah,
he
Barbie.
Was
with,
yeah.
He was with, Barbie yeah, guy. He was put in charge of fixing Barbie's sales problems. She had one bad year, and they were like, oh, Barbie's done.
Right.
And he's like, what? That's crazy. Barbie's like one of the most well-known brands. Well, you know, we'll diversify Barbie, we'll make a high-end Barbie, a low-end Barbie, a Dr. Barbie, a lawyer Barbie, and it'll be fine. And it was. And then they put him in charge of He-Man. And
yeah,
He-Man. He did amazing things.
He-Man?
They paid Filmation to produce those cartoons as essentially commercials that they gave to networks for free. They were like, you don't have to pay us for these cartoons. Just air them, and all we want is, like, some commercial time so we can show the toys to the kids while they're watching the cartoons. And the stations were like, hell yes, we'll take free cartoons.
Which was also illegal at the time.
Yeah. Well. But Kalinske was masterful at that, and he brought that to Sega. And it's no secret that that's what helped them, you know, make that crucial leap ahead of Nintendo in the U.S. market, which ultimately won them a, you know, battle in the console war.
For a short amount of time.
It seems like, I mean, focusing on Sega for a book like this makes sense because it's the only way you can focus on it, I think, because really the console war was started by Sega.
It was.
Because, I mean, Nintendo was just sort of taking what they did on the NES and doing more of it and refining it. Sega was the one who came in and tried with the Genesis to make it sort of like an arcade in your home thing. Didn't work out too well in the 89.
Right.
But then switched gears and started picking a fight with Nintendo, like a Pepsi Coke kind of thing.
No, you're totally right.
And,
like, I don't.
And they're the ones who. They are. The console wars is really about. They really are the star.
Not only did they start it, but I look at. We're going to talk about game history briefly. I think in the pre 8-bit era, in the VCS, Atari, Intellivision, ColecoVision era, those were like kind of similar tribes from the same nation, maybe like throwing volleys at each other. But it wasn't until Nintendo versus Sega where you had like the Civil War. They were lined up and like calling each other out, like,
right.
I'm going to take the first shot at you. And then they would pick each other off. And then you move forward into the next generation, and it was more of a tactical, you know, you start getting into a business war. But Sega versus Nintendo was like a bloody Civil War battle. They were picking each other off especially from across the battlefield.
Especially since both sides had their plus, like, you know, like, when you say, like, okay, like, the Nintendo people could say, like, well, we have this game, the Sega people could say, we have this game. And in a way, it was accurate, because some things were better on the Super Nintendo, other things were better on the you know, the Genesis. I mean, you know, all the sports games on the Genesis were so much better. On the, you know, you had like Earthworm Jim and Mickey Mania were better on the Genesis. Then the Super Nintendo got Mario Kart, and you know, you had like you know, various, like, you know, the Squaresoft RPGs and stuff like that. So it was like really like everybody was able to sort of bring something to the fight. So nobody was really like a second class citizen in that case. It wasn't like where one came out and just completely dominated. It was almost like evenly matched.
Even the attack ads that Sega manufactured their, you know, blast processing, or having Sonic the Hedgehog be like the cool kid, and the kid playing Nintendo was like a nerd with glasses and suspenders. Attack ads. I mean, think about, again, back to the Atari era. You had competing consoles, but advertisements would show like comparison pictures of both systems, not in a kind of a matter-of-fact way. Like, this is what our game looks like on Commodore 64. This is what it looks like on Atari. Right. This is what it looks like on... And it wasn't like they suck. It was just like, look, here they are. These were like attack ads. These were really vicious and to the point. Like, that console sucks. Buy ours.
Which was, and you wrote about this, Kalinske really, really had a tough time convincing the Japanese Sega to go ahead and do that, because they were like, no, you can't do that. You can't insult the, competitor. We don't allow that here.
And yeah, and his main defense was basically like, well, what we're doing is not working. Well, like, we should at least try this.
Yeah.
I mean, it might fail, but we were already failing. Yeah, and I loved the attack ads. My favorite is the one with is the Game Boy versus Game Gear, and the dog. Only, you know, a dog can only see in black and white, and it's like, well, if you like things in black and white, you may as well be drinking out of the toilet. And like, kind of to what you were saying about like the back and forth and how it was kind of like a civil war between the two of them, it always surprised me during the research how long it took for Nintendo to respond, and part of that also speaks to why the book is more focused on Sega. Because they were the decision makers, and they can do things. Like, one of my favorite chapters, and I know one of the favorite memories of those involved, was like that last minute price drop at CES when they found out at like midnight that Nintendo was dropping the price. So they were able to, like, within 8 hours, staying up all night to actually do something that changed their presentation. But a lot of the people at Nintendo, even when I did speak with them, I would be like, well, why did you guys do this? And they're like, oh, Japan told us. Or it's like, Arakawa and Howard Lincoln told us, and that's not like a criticism of Arakawa and Lincoln. That was just their leadership style, that it was very top down. But aside from speaking to them, the other people, it was like they helped execute it, but there wasn't that, like, you know, in that respect with Atari, where it was like they were flying by the seat of their pants. Sega was like the best of both worlds with that, because they were flying by the seat of their pants, but they did have like a strategic objective. It wasn't just like, well, let's just try this. It was, here's five things we can try. Let's figure out which is the best. And so it was really fun to research.
Now, in your opinion, though, was that sort of like, may have, like, it worked for the time, for that brief period of time? Do you think that also may have caused the collapse after a while?
Yeah, because, I mean, it's like, a good question, if it's unsustainable or not.
Like, and how long do you, like, where do you think that sort of, like, where do you think that benefit ends and it starts becoming a liability?
Well,
when suddenly, like,
no, it's a really good question, because you could say, like, you know, in the, like, what they were trying to sell, like, to the public, and from the perception standpoint, is like, you know, welcome to the next level, we are better technology, we are for an older audience. And part of that is like, all right, we're going to offer a Sega CD, we're going to offer a 32X, we're going to offer you all these advancements that our competitor is not offering you. And in the end, that hurt them. But I think that all of that would have been forgiven if their next console was successful. Because I think that you forget about, like, the 32X. And I think the Sega CD gets a worse reputation in hindsight just because, yeah, it was another piece of crap that led to more pieces of crap. But if they had launched, like, you know, there were, in the book, they wanted to basically partner with Silicon Graphics, who made the N64. Right. They wanted to partner with Sony. If they had launched something that was even a number two in the market, I think that we would be a little more forgiving of those technological blunders.
Yeah, a lot of people talk about, briefly, a lot of people talk about Nintendo's potential partnership with Sony and creating the PlayStation. Sega also had something very similar almost happen, and Sega or Sony, who backed out of that one? Did Sega of Japan said no, right?
Saturn.
They said we don't want this.
Yeah, like one of the main strategies from Sega was to form a cartel of Nintendo's enemies. So it was like, all right, Nintendo was suing Galoob for making this Game Genie, which kids seem to like. Instead of suing them, let's actually like partner. Mm. Let's work with them. Same thing with the rental houses. You know,
well, in the United States.
In the United States, yeah, and Sony also was one that got publicly humiliated at the CES show in 1991, and also just in general was like Nintendo kept them hanging and didn't really respect a partnership with them. And Sega had a very close relationship with them, with ImageSoft. Sega helped teach some of their engineers how to make games for the Sega CD. They basically, like literally at the same event, they launched the Sega CD, so it was like, even though it was a Sega console, it was kind of like a joint effort, and they were speaking about doing a joint console together. I suspect that over time, Sony probably still would have went on their own.
Yeah, whatever.
Once they learned how to do it and didn't need Sega anymore, but it would have increased the lifespan of Sega and would have been more successful than Saturn.
Sony ImageSoft software that launched with the Sega CD, I think.
Yeah,
right?
There was.
And what was anything packed in that was Sony ImageSoft? Were the Sherlock Holmes games?
Sewer Shark was an ImageSoft.
Well, but those were
I
made
like
for. There was a previous system.
Yeah. Right, the VHS.
The JVC. Wasn't it like a JVC?
It was the Nemo.
Nemo.
Yeah, it was so funny that in 1993 they had the Senate subcommittee hearings, which were. I feel like we remember it more as about Mortal Kombat, but like it was probably more about Night Trap and Sewer Shark because that was like the full motion video that Senator Lieberman could actually be like, that's so much
look
like a
Dana
movie.
Look at Dana Plato.
Yeah.
Look at her.
And the funny
America's
thing was,
sweetheart.
Those games were actually made 5 years earlier for a different console, and Sega was, Sony owned the rights, and Sega kind of took it off their hands, and they split them up, and it was like, that wasn't like a breakthrough product for the console, but that was what got them in trouble.
So now we just got done talking about the conflict that, you know, between Sega of America and Sega Japan. Would you say that this came to a head with the Saturn? Like, when do you think, like, because like, that really when the honeymoon was over?
Yeah, it was, because like I think from like a poetic standpoint, to me that symbolized the end of that like golden era of what Sega was doing in America, because one of the early important moments in the story and kind of just like epitomized the shift between what Sega had been doing before and Sega under the Kalinske regime was that 4-point plan that he delivered in Japan. And he said they want to bundle in Sonic with the console, they want to lower the price, they want to go after Nintendo, and all these things that the Japanese disagreed with. But the net result was Nakayama saying, like, no one agrees with you, but I hired you to do this, so you have the autonomy to do what you want. And with the Saturn, it was like, no one agrees with you, and we're not going to give you the autonomy to do what you want. So even though they were successful, you know, that to me was kind of like the breaking point or the point of no return. And one thing I always really respected about Tom, and I don't think I mentioned in the book, was I had lunch with Ellen Beth Van Buskirk, who was the PR person at Sega, and she was telling me she left in 93. And she had a lunch with Tom in like 95 after during the Saturn debacle era, and she was saying, Tom was talking about how bad it was, and she said, like, why don't you just leave? And he said, you know, I feel like it's my responsibility to go down with the ship, like, you know,
I'm the captain,
and so he did ride it out for another year, and he was certainly looking elsewhere and had a good job lined up, but like that was what really struck me during my interviews was the camaraderie that these people felt. Paul Rio as well, who had actually been in Vietnam and had been in a real war, and obviously this is a metaphorical war, but he did make comparisons between corporate warfare and business warfare and the importance of, like, this camaraderie and let's say and Shinobu too. Like the management didn't want to step down because they didn't want to let down anyone else. But once everyone was kind of gone, it was the end.
One name that gets thrown around a lot regarding like the Saturn's failure in America is Bernie Stolar. Now, he's sort of like the typically named villain of Sega of America. Would you say that that's earned, or maybe like not maybe that's unfair?
Ray Kazar,
maybe that's unfair. Like as far as naming people,
yeah,
in executives in America who get lambasted, would you say that's unfair to name them the villains, or was it more Sega of Japan that caused the problems? Or
well, I think it's
or was it a combination?
I would say two things. One is that like Bernie came after Tom, and so like my knowledge of his tenure at Sega is very limited. So like I don't have too much information there, but I do think that you really only get one chance to make a first impression with a lot of these things, though I guess the Genesis was the exception. So they really hit the ground poorly, and they upset retailers who didn't get enough consoles, and so I don't think that I don't know how much more Bernie could have done by the time he got in there.
Well, the fanboys hate him because he canceled the Dreamcast, right?
Right.
But it's like, what else are you supposed to do?
Yeah.
It wasn't selling. The PS2 was coming. Everybody was going to buy the PS2. That's why they hadn't been buying the Dreamcast. And
I mean, the big failure of Sega is that they didn't have like a united vision between America and Japan. And say what you will about Nintendo, but they at least did. And part of that's probably because it was very Japanese-controlled, and also because the son-in-law was actually running it here, so there was a relationship. But like, because the Dreamcast, I thought, was a great console, but there was like once again problems between America and Japan and sales problems, and the Saturn failed here, but it sold a little bit better there. And so I don't know. I don't think Bernie should get all the blame. One thing that I thought was funny with Bernie was, though Bernie was kind of outside the scope of my research, I wanted to speak with anyone just why not, to give me like some contextual information, or maybe he knew some things that I didn't know. So I took him out to lunch at the Grand Central, like the seafood place there, and we had a really nice time together. I then went back to his apartment later that week, and he gave me like a DVD of him speaking about something. And so like I thought that we had like a decent relationship, but then after the book came out, he emailed people from Sega that are mentioned in the book. He's like, I can't believe this guy never talked to me. I was like, Bernie, what are you talking about?
Maybe
I took you out for a nice lunch. So my opinion of him is just as like
confusing.
A little bit of aloof. So that's why I feel like I can't speak accurately to like his leadership, because that was just my personal experience with him. But I do think it would probably be unfair to put a problem with him to give him this problem that was already going on before he got there.
There was, what else is it going to do? I mean, there were the Saturn disaster, just the multifaceted disaster that it was. It was they couldn't recover. I mean, they could maybe have recovered, but because Sony was there, there was no room for it. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't room. This really still isn't room for three manufacturers.
Yeah, let's talk about Nintendo nowadays, because obviously, Sega's not around, and they don't make hardware anymore, and they do make software, but they kind of just live off the Sonic IP, and the software they make is pretty lousy for the most part.
They admitted so. What? Not too long ago. A couple weeks ago, they admitted, we know our game sucked, we're going to fix that.
Aren't they making...
they said that.
I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, but the solution is more iOS apps.
Yeah,
Endless Runners.
No, I thought they were like going more into like casino
more
games.
But that's always been there, right? They're run by Sega Sammy.
Konami.
Oh, okay.
And always doing like the pachinko stuff.
Yeah. Because there's massive money in that. I mean, and that's not a bad business move. If you're based in Japan and you can make, billions of dollars in casino halls and, I don't know, hundreds of thousands in game consoles, what would you...
Game consoles aren't selling over there at all. Now.
Right,
they sold like a million PS4s. That's it.
Yeah, but it's all mobile. Japan is like totally mobile now.
So where it raises the ire of the market and the consumers who love their products in the past, it's just not a sustainable future for them as a company, and they'll wind up completely bankrupt if they focus entirely on game consoles and video games.
And so what do you guys expect for the future of Nintendo? There's now talk of them doing a new console, which...
Well, personally, we've talked about this once or twice as far as where we think they're going to go. Personally, what I think is happening is, like, with this NX that they're bringing out, I think that what they're going to be doing is they're going to try to very slowly, which I think they more or less have been doing, is very slowly kill the Wii U by withholding a lot of, like, key titles. So gotcha, keep, so they can't just kill it outright because they'll piss off too many customers, but they're going to, like, sort of, like, let it starve for a little bit.
And then not only piss off customers, but piss off shareholders, which they've been doing a lot of lately, and that's...
What I think they're going to probably do is they're probably going to try to rebrand the Wii U as not really, wasn't really supposed to be their next-gen system. They'll probably try to say, like, oh, this was always, like, an offshoot of the Wii brand that served its purpose. The NX, now this is our real entry into the next generation, and try to, like, smooth it over that way.
I think physically it will probably be a morphing of some in some way mobile, but yet not entirely mobile. In a sense, so they're giving you an option that is somewhere above tablets, but below PC, because a lot of people don't use PCs anymore, or your laptop or something like that. That's backed by their obviously by their first party games. I probably think that's where they're going. Now, does that work? I mean, look, there's plenty of companies out there that subsist right now and do perfectly fine and make money without a huge market share of their industry. I think a lot of video game fans look at that and say, well, that's not acceptable. Then Nintendo is dead. But they don't know what their balance sheet looks like. They have no idea. You're never going to know what it looks like.
Right.
Totally. So that's probably where I think they're going. So for people who think that 5 years from now Nintendo will be out of business, I think they're mistaken.
Right.
Yeah. I think it'll be some type of hybrid, like Greg said, of a portable system, because the strength in the Japanese market right now is on mobile gaming and portable, and that's Nintendo's home base. And no matter how wildly successful that they are in any other region, they must serve their public and their nation and where they, you know, where their heart and their mind is. And the Wii U sells badly here, and from what we understand, it sells just as badly, if not worse, in the Japanese region. So,
why do you guys think it sells so badly? I have a Wii U. I think it's good.
I think it's a good system in terms of Nintendo delivering conceptually what they say. But even that, I mean, okay.
I don't think it's the Wii U. I think it started with the Wii. The Wii was extremely popular. Here's the thing, though. The Wii was sort of like a pop music, like boy band or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, they're very popular because they're young and all that. And then once, you know, a few years down the line, the 16, 14-year-old girls have grown up and they're like, I don't care about them anymore.
Right.
And so now their shelf life has kind of been pushed out. So I think the Wii was very successful with a lot of casual gamers, people who grew up with the NES or...
Right.
Genesis, whatever. And eventually, once those people kind of got, were like, this novelty to the remote Wiimote, who cares? Once that bottomed out, what were they left with? They weren't left with the hardcore gamers anymore, which were, maybe those people had a Wii, but they also had the Xbox 360. Right. They also had the PS3.
It's tough, though, because, I mean, the way they presented the Wii U was very confusing for a lot of people. Because it looks like a Wii, it's called a Wii, and
their
lineup for six months didn't really look much like anything.
That like so many of their hit titles for the Wii were called Wii Sports, Wii Fit. Yeah. Now to think that Wii U wasn't a Wii University Education thing, but actually a whole new console, like I feel like conceptually that was just what's their Wii Universe? It's the education series. You know, like
they were trying to sell a new console with a game with games like Mass Effect 3 that.
It's underpowered for third-party developers. All the third-party developers backed out because they said it's going to cost us more money to downscale the things that we're working on for PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360 and the next generation of PlayStation 4 and Xbox One to put them on your console. We have to pay we have to farm them out to a third-party developer to work under us, so it's going to cost us double, and we're not going to even make half back, so why bother? Now, I don't disagree with Nintendo's idea of tablet gaming and mobile gaming is the next wave. So we will take the strength of what we did with DS, which is undeniably, like, it's kept them, you know, in, right, in money, in flush with money for many, many years. Let's take that technology, put it into a controller, which is in the realm of the popularity of the mobile and tablet format, and integrate that in a home console that's similar to the Wii. We'll use some of the Wii hardware, so it's backwards compatible. People will be able to carry their libraries over. On paper, it all makes sense.
But it was $100 more.
Yeah.
Because of the stupid controller.
And just in execution, it just, it's just one of those things where it was just a conflagration of things that just didn't work and it burned out.
It's like, tough for Nintendo because they're in a position where they have to make a choice. Do they want to be satisfied with the way it was in the N64 to a certain extent the GameCube, where basically they're running the show? Or do they want these other third parties? Because these other third parties are not going to be jumping on board if they have to choose between either releasing crappier versions of their main games on there, or do like exclusive development on a console like what Nintendo's doing. But you know, exclusivity
doesn't
work anymore.
That's always been their problem. It's just like that exclusivity doesn't work anymore.
In a way, Nintendo almost if they don't want to be doing everything on their own anymore, they have to think. Well, maybe more bring up new developers.
That's the problem. We just mentioned Konami. Konami, yeah. Capcom, Hudson, which is, I think, owned by Konami now.
Yeah.
All the classic Japanese developers, publishing houses that Nintendo was tight with,
have all
they're all dead. Yep. Mm-hmm. They're just about. They've gone down
with Nintendo. The properties
are
out there for people to pick up, you know, in some cases, but a lot of those houses have closed or moved on to other things like pachinko machines.
I think Yamauchi put it perfectly. I saw it on the internet. Somebody had written this long retrospective of the GameCube several years ago, and they asked him about that. Like, and his thing was like, somebody had interviewed him, and he was like, he couldn't understand why the GameCube wasn't outselling the Xbox or the PS2. He's like, you know, we're more or less cheaper. You know, he's like, I don't get it. We're out there to sell games that are fun. We sell fun. That was right. Nintendo, and I guess it still is. And he didn't, whether or not he's wrong or right, he just didn't understand why the general public, particularly in the West, had gone from fun games to the new generation of games, which is mostly killing things.
Yeah.
I mean, that's most of the game. You think about it, that's most, other than the RPGs and the strategy stuff, which is on the outskirts anyway.
Yeah, I mean, they don't really do first-person shooters, and their version was like Splatoon, which is a very Nintendo version of like a killing shooting.
Right. Well, they had Metroid Prime, but even that—I mean, even that was, you know, Nintendo-ized. It wasn't like kill, kill, kill.
I think where it'll be really interesting is, you know, the hardware and software sales aside, the number one thing that Nintendo has that no one else in the game industry has is the IPs, is Mario, Luigi, Donkey Kong, all these characters. And in terms of like making what they do not feel like a novelty, but actually continuing to grow with their customer base, it'll be interesting to see how, if at all, they choose to really embrace that. Like the idea of like a theme park thing that they're apparently working on, that's like because if you compare them to Disney, all right, it's not that Disney just made cartoons. They also had Disney World, they had Disneyland, they had these plush dolls, like they had everything around it. They had this whole infrastructure so that you felt like you can connect with Disney beyond just watching the cartoons. And I feel like that's something that Nintendo has not fully taken advantage of, and part of that's like, everyone has, even though mobile gaming is more popular in Japan, everyone has a phone, and they have not been on the phones. I know they're changing that now, but they haven't been because of that philosophy. It's like, we're going to do it our own and control everything, or we're not going to do it at all. And there's something romantic about watching someone. Like, it reminds, did you guys ever see the movie Tin Cup?
Yeah, sure.
Like, it reminds me of the end where it's like, he just doesn't want anyone to help him. He just wants to do it on his own.
He will not lay up.
Won't lay up. It's like, I'm either going to fail doing it my way or succeed, but I'm just going to do it my way, and I won't take suggestions or help from anyone. And it's like romantic to watch, but it's also sad because you want him and you want Nintendo to succeed, and it's like, guys.
So essentially Nintendo is Kevin Costner hitting a ball into the water, like over and over again.
With Cheech Marin in the background.
Yeah, but Roy McAvoy does get Rene Russo at the end, so maybe Nintendo...
We'll get Rene Russo.
But he didn't win. Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think that their culture, the Japanese culture as part of Nintendo, is very, obviously very pervasive. And it worked for a long, long time. And I just feel like You know, unfortunately, it doesn't work anymore.
I think what Nintendo will have going forward, as gaming enthusiasts and collectors and historians as we are, I think what Nintendo will have with their recent game consoles, even the ones like the Wii U that are a commercial failure, is 20 years from now, you're not going to find game as many gamers passionately coming into a game store like Digital Press saying, oh, you do you have that first Xbox? I really need all those games that Microsoft made for that first Xbox. But you will have gamers coming in here 20 years from now saying, like, I really want to play Mario Kart 8. I need that Wii U. Like, the first-party stuff are like linchpin titles. They're tentpoles. You're going to have people continuing to go back as long as, I mean, Nintendo doesn't, you know, re-release them on the next system, which they may do. But I think that historically, Nintendo, their first-party stuff has a longevity like the Disney Masterworks. You know, you'll rebuy them over and over again.
Nintendo's IPs are very much a generational thing. Because if you really look at it, like, look at all the Zeldas, look at all the Mario Karts, they really aren't that different from each other. At their core, what you're being asked to do in each game pretty much stays consistent.
Right.
That's the point.
In the new Zelda games, you're just being asked to do more of it. Like, you know, instead of finding 8 keys, you're finding 18 or something like that. But generally speaking, it's all sort of like doing the same thing over and over again. What that means is that a lot of people, they have sort of like their Zelda, their Mario Kart. Like, for me, it's like if I think Mario Kart, my Mario Kart is Mario Kart 64. Somebody else's Mario Kart is Double Dash or Mario Kart 7. So every generation sort of has their mid-court game, like Nintendo games. And so they, when it comes time, when they get turned, like when they're 25, 30 years old, they have a lot of, like, you know, like, you know, income to, you know, to blow on, like, you know, their childhood, you know, their childhood entertainment. They go back to what they played at like 10, 12 years old, which was whatever generation Nintendo was.
Which makes you wonder why Nintendo still won't do a flashback system.
Yeah, that's good. But like what you're describing, which I think is very true and accurate, it reminds me a lot of comic books also. Like, you know, Daredevil 400 is kind of the same story as Daredevil 10. It's just one is My Daredevil, one is a newer thing. But what Marvel has done such a good job of is taking that IP and making the movies around them, making the TV shows around them, so that I'm more interested in buying the new Daredevil comic, even though it's not my generation, or I'm more interested in buying these things. And I feel like Nintendo has all these great intellectual properties, all these great characters. They need to find a way to embrace that so that people will be curious and buy a Wii U or be curious and buy a DS.
I still think it comes back to what he said, is the people aren't... I don't think at the end of the day, they seem fine with not having fun, with games that are not simply fun, that are just...
Well, it's like getting a kid to eat his vegetables. Sometimes you gotta put some cheese on it. You know, you gotta mask it in something like Splatoon. Like, hey guys, this is a first-person shooter. It's something much more.
Like the Uncharted series. I'm looking at a Borderlands display over there. I just can't get into those games where you're just wandering and doing things.
Clearly you haven't played Uncharted. It's not just wandering.
It
has Nolan North, the most handsome voice talent in all of video games.
All right. One of the things I was going to ask you about was two of my favorite characters in the book. They're not the real people, but one is...
Have you considered doing an animated series of Console Wars?
One is Al Nielsen, who you mentioned, who was like one of the big engineers at Sega.
He was a marketing guy.
And he was pretty eccentric, I guess you could say, a little bit. He was wild. He had a lot of great quotes in there from him. And the other one was Peter Main from Nintendo, who seemed to only be completely and utterly incensed by everything that Sega did. I don't know. There were two characters that were really fun to read about. So I don't know. They really like that, I guess.
Yeah, I think they're really like.
Peter Main seemed very angry. Very angry.
He was very angry all the time.
The bald headed syndrome or something, but.
No, but that's not... Like, to me, a lot of the struggle of Peter Main was... It's like that situation where... it's almost like a bad example. This is a bad example, but like when Johnny Manziel recently was in the news because, like, someone was saying negative things to him, and everyone knows, like, you should just not do anything, man. If you do something, you're going to be in the news. But you want to do something. You don't want to be disrespected. And Pyramid wanted to fight back, but Japan wouldn't let them. So it was like, ugh. So he had to like walk his dog every morning to like calm down and remember like we can't sink to their level. Like, because Nintendo thought that it was important too, and that they were above that, so they didn't really engage Sega. And I can understand when you're the person being treated as a punching bag, why you would be frustrated by that.
So the other thing, like Al Nielsen, Tom Kalinske, they've been, I think you've been with them a few times. They've, over the past year or so, they've been doing a lot of conventions, comic conventions, video game conventions. I mean, it's, some people might call it like a victory lap, but it just, it seems cool that these guys now are out there, they're doing panels, people are getting to hear their story for the first time, and which I really like, and I find Kalinske a very, I'm not going to say a heroic character, but he's definitely someone that you could look up to in the industry, and yet, maybe it's just the fanboys, I don't know. But good God, they hate him.
Yeah.
They hate him. I don't know why. They just, like, they, everything that they just nitpick, and so, one of the nitpicks that I hear about your book a lot on the internet is,
yes,
I know,
it's
a
what people nitpick on the internet?
Is that they've gotten to the point now where they're not nitpicking the concepts of Kalinske said this happened. No, we're not debating that. Now they're debating, well, Kalinske said this happened on April the 3rd of 1992, but we've got all the evidence here, and this really happened in June, so whatever he said is impossible. Could not have happened because the dates don't jive. And I'm like, yeah, you know that happened 20 years ago? The guy is trying to recall to the best of...
I know what, like, listen, yeah, it would be irresponsible for me if I took Tom Kalinske's word for any of these things as the final word. I always spoke with other people and always tried to find supplemental documentation. But, like, in terms of the date thing, I read a good article by Frank Cifaldi a few years ago, I think at Game of Sutra, about the release of Mario Brothers... Super Mario Brothers for the NES, and
yeah,
they don't even know.
They don't even know the exact date.
So if you can't find the exact date of the most important video game of the entire decade, perhaps even most important console game ever, you got to give a little leeway. And I was able to get a lot of primary source documents, which was helpful for me. Like I got the like promotional stuff for the Mall Tour, so I could see okay, they're at this mall on this day. Like so, it helped me. But you know, I think that the reason that people nitpick Tom is because I think what's so great about him is that he was an outsider to the video game industry, and that he, like, he's not a gamer. He enjoyed playing video games. He likes video games. I see him play with his sons nowadays, but he's not like a hardcore gamer. And so I can understand why someone criticizes him, saying like, who do you think you are coming in and like telling us how to do this thing? And you know, he was a marketing guy. He wanted to tell stories. He felt the same way about He-Man and about Barbie. These were like storytelling opportunities for him. He didn't go home and play with dolls. And so I think that some people resent the fact that he was not a hardcore gamer, and he's also a very handsome guy. So,
well, sometimes you know, sometimes you don't want, you know, like the inmates running the asylum kind of thing.
That's
sometimes,
what Atari was.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes it is helpful to have somebody from the outside come in.
I also think
a
it's
fresh look. You know,
I also think it's almost chic to be a this fan of, let's say, the Saturn, because, you know, a lot of the Saturn library, if you look at today, is Japanese. It was never ported over here because it failed. So it's almost chic to be a fan of Sega's Japanese works and not realize that, you know, you wouldn't be playing anything Sega if it wasn't for the people in Northern California, you know, bringing it to
like
you.
Tom, to me, and even the way I think he talks about this, is like he was the coach of this team. He didn't create Sonic the Hedgehog. He helped make him a cultural phenomenon.
Yeah,
but
he
like,
didn't want it to be like a scary fang-looking guy.
Right, but like in terms of a coach, if you have like the results on the field that like back it up, and you also have in the locker room, like if you ask any of these people in the book from Sega, or 95% of them would say Tom was like the greatest boss they've ever had. So the combination of the actual results and the actual you know, confirmation of what it was like, I mean, I think it's really hard to give much credence to anybody who wants to take Tom down. You know, Bill Belichick makes mistakes and does things wrong, but like
he cheats
in the totality of
the
events.
Cheater.
I think he deserves the benefit of the doubt when it comes to like the results are there and the people genuinely feel this affection for him and inspiration from him. And that was also part of why I started early on with that chapter about what he did for the Flintstones kid chewable vitamins, what he did for Barbie, what he did for He-Man, what he did for Matchbox Cars, because a few people told me from the Nintendo side, like, you know, Tom basically was given Sonic the Hedgehog and, like, a monkey could have done his job. Like, he basically just lucked out. And, like, you know, there is a way of looking at the story where Tom is just a really lucky guy, but if you think lightning strikes that many times for this guy, then he's just the luckiest guy in the world. And, like, there's a reason that everywhere he goes, special things happen, and I think it's foolish to...
What I was going to say is, like, it's funny how you bring up, like, people at Nintendo were sort of, like, trying to poo-poo Tom,
right.
But if you look at... What I find is interesting is that, also when you say how Nintendo wasn't going to respond to Sega, it's funny how, in a way, almost, though, they sort of did, in a very roundabout way. They didn't respond directly by attacking him, but around, like, 94, 95, they went with sort of, like, a marketing system that was a marketing style that was almost, like, gross-out.
The Play It Loud campaign?
Yeah, with, like, you know, with the Earthbound, with This Game Stinks, and which apparently didn't help the game too much. Or, like, you know, the Game Boy, the multicolored Game Boy,
yeah.
With the tongues, the painted tongues, and everything like that.
Yeah.
It's almost like, I mean...
They definitely
was
did.
That was that
that was the point
was that
where
like
they
sort
really
of like
started
a, like a
to...
stealth response or started trying to like was that trying to get into that same sort of like the quote unquote badass kind of
that was definitely them trying to kind of copy
respond to
Nintendo. I think that I think that it doesn't withstand the test of time, those advertisements,
yeah.
And that style, but I think it actually worked really well because it was that like badass attitude and that like yeah we're cool, we're hip, we're not just total kid stuff, but it worked so well because they had Donkey Kong Country and they had Killer Instinct and they had like three of each game,
mm-hmm.
And that was all that. Those were the games that were being heavily promoted by that, and those were perfect games that worked with that style of like, yeah, I remember playing Nintendo as a kid, but now they're kind of cool and they
mm-hmm.
got this. There's no denying that Donkey Kong Country was like the coolest looking game at the time. So Nintendo did respond, but that was like 4 years
yeah.
later.
So we mentioned briefly the Nintendo PlayStation cooperative that went away, and then Philips got involved, and then I think there was also a Nintendo Sony Philips cooperative right there at the end before that dissipated also. So recently there was a guy, he lives in Denver, Colorado, but his father lives somewhere in Philadelphia area, I think in New Jersey, and he made news because he went home and went through his dad's attic and found this prototype version of the Nintendo PlayStation, which had originally belonged
exist.
To...
Olaf Olafson.
There you go. Who was with Sony ImageSoft and had it in his office in New York when whatever the company that he had started went out of business. And they literally went in there, and this guy's father went in there as part of the like the cleanup crew, and everything in the business had been repossessed or whatever, so he... But he kept that, and he kept other systems, including that one. So,
we are, and our online community has spoken directly. I mean, he's a part of our online community to Jerry Jessup, who is the head engineer at Sony and has been with them. He was with Atari previously, and he confirmed that, you know, while he didn't see that exact iteration of that prototyped Nintendo PlayStation, that around that time there were similar builds and that looked legit to him. So, I mean, where there are some deniers out there on the web that think it's like 3D printed or something.
That was actually a joke, and everybody took it to be somebody like with an authority saying, "Well, this is not true." And everybody was like, "Oh my God, is this? Are we being pranked? Now what?"
That's really funny.
Yeah,
but it was true.
Olaf. The first time I met Olaf really changed the way that I thought about the book and how I presented it because, you know, Sony was famously scorned about what killed that deal, basically, and going with Philips and basically just not treating Sony very well or not wanting to embrace the partnership.
I think they were fearful of them.
Yeah, they were. And so I had heard theories about how... I had heard that, like, Sony was bitter and all these things that were partially true, but when I asked Olaf, you know, what happened or how did you feel when you... when Nintendo severed that partnership, and he said, "I felt relieved." And I said, "Relieved? You must have been bitter." And he's like, "Well, you know, like maybe, no, I mean, like, sure, it was a little embarrassing." But he said, "I felt the way that Nintendo treated the people that their partners, I felt like we were slaves on a plantation."
Mm-hmm.
And I was so happy not to be in that situation anymore. And like, slaves on a plantation is a very dramatic metaphor to use, but I felt like that's how serious he felt. And so for me, that was when I started to really think about this story as like Game of Thrones, and it was everyone kind of vying for the throne, and they all felt differently about their competitors, but that's what it was. And so that was kind of how I tried to write the book. So these three households, all alike in dignity, going for the Iron Throne.
This would make a great HBO series as well as a movie. Yeah. And you could get Sean Bean, and he could play Kalinske and be dead by the end somehow.
I guess there's gonna be a lot of male nudity in this.
Yes,
pretty.
I think Kelsey Grammer should play Kalinske. Grammer kind of looks like him.
Do you have any dream casting for the movie?
Not really. I tried to not think about it when I was writing it, and I also knew the people, so I knew what they looked like. Though early on, I imagined Aaron Eckhart as Kalinske. I was like, thank you for Smoking Guy, but less full of shit and more like, you know, a little bit more sincere about kids and imagination, but still kind of that like unflappable charisma and a little bit of a salesman sensibility to him, because that's what he was.
Now, do you think on the heels of Pixels that a video game movie can succeed?
I definitely do.
they spoiled it.
Yeah, I mean, I know from my experiences like in Hollywood that so much of what you hear is based on something else, meaning that like if that movie had been very successful, then probably 10 pitches for Pixels like things would have sold, and it's really easy for someone to go in with a pitch now in a studio to just say like, oh no, Pixels failed. But this is like a different kind of movie. This is, you know, we've always kind of thought about it like The Social Network, where it's this behind the scenes story that just so happens to be about video games. I mean, that's a lot of what it's about, but it's different. You know, there's not going to be CGI characters in this, and so that makes it a different kind of a story. And I think if anything, in addition to our love for superhero movies this past decade, we've started to really love like superhumans or business stories, whether it's like the Jobs movie or whether it's Mark Zuckerberg and Social Network. I think people really like to see the behind the scenes of these iconic, of how iconic things were made and the drama that went on.
So we won't have like an over the top Bill Gates, Anthony Michael Hall from Pirates of Silicon Valley.
I really love that movie.
I so did I. But
I thought Noah Wiley was awesome.
I can't believe that it's accurate.
No.
Completely.
I don't know. We'll see.
I have a question about the structure of the book. What prompted you to go with a non-linear chronological chapter structure?
That's a great question. Well, I mean, for the most part, it's pretty linear, but like the historical stuff with Nintendo and stuff like that, I think it's because some of my favorite nonfiction books, especially like the behind the scenes business ones, like Barbarians at the Gate is a famous one about the RJR and Nabisco merger and the history of the tobacco industry. And a lot of these books, and also Disney War, the first like 50 pages are historical, and I'm not invested in any characters, and especially in the case of RJR and Nabisco, I'm not really invested in like Reynolds cigarettes. That I feel like, you know, and I was telling you in the car, I think the main job of the author is to find out how to make information accessible and compelling. And I think that starting off in 1889 with the creation of Nintendo, like, that's not Mario. That's not something I know. That's not a person, a face I could put on that. Like, I don't care. But I do care about it when it's, oh, maybe they're not so bad after all, or, oh, that's why they are the way they are. And so that was why, I tried not to do it to the extent that it would confuse readers and you felt, like, displaced in time. And actually, one great suggestion I got was to put the time, like, the dates with each chapter. Mm-hmm. But because sometimes I didn't know what the dates were and I didn't want to, I never made up stuff when I didn't have the information, I didn't want like some question marks on chapters. So that was why, I hope it wasn't too jarring, but that was why I felt.
It wasn't. It definitely wasn't. But it was something as I was reading,
it's
like,
a good question.
I was like, man, if I ever get to ask him. Now I did. Bucket list, check.
So, Console Wars paperback, I believe, is out now.
It is,
yeah. Yeah, this is the hardcover here. But and then the documentary. So the documentary basically will be, the focus will be on the material from Console Wars. I mean,
it's like 15 sit-down interviews with Tom, right. Howard, Al, all these people, and it's...
Is that in the can? Is it like all shot?
Yeah. We have a cut, like an 85, 90-minute version that, like, my mom could watch it and think like it was done. Like it's enough. It tells a story, though it still needs, you know, work and also post production stuff. So we're hoping that by the end of the year, we'll finish it up. But you know, all the interviews are done and it's all structurally together. But it was interesting to take what's obviously a long book and to condense it to 90 minutes. And you miss a lot. But again, as with like the goal of writing, I think the goal, you need to create accessible content. So for a 90-minute movie, you can't spend as much time talking about everything that went into Sonic Tuesday because that itself could be like a 90-minute movie.
And the reality is you're going to hit probably 20 times more people with the documentary than they are ever going to be from the book.
Right. Yeah, so you just hit like the big moments. And it's fun because I really tried not to rely on nostalgia when writing this. I thought a lot of people brought their own experiences into it, which is good, as you should and as I did, but like I wanted this to be my ideal reader for writing the book was my grandma, who doesn't know anything about video games, but I thought if I can write a video game story that she cares about and isn't based on like, oh, I remember this and that's why I care, then that was important. Yeah. The documentary, though, we can really rely on nostalgia because we have grainy footage, we have trade show footage, we have these commercials, we have all these things that, you know, we can make sure that everyone's at least having the same experience, even if we relate to it in different ways.
Now, you mentioned you spent 3 years writing the book, correct? For somebody who, say, is an aspiring writer, what would your recommendation be as far as, like, how often would you actually sit at the keyboard and, like,
it's a good question.
Like, per day and, like, you know, what your, like, what, like, as far as a work ethic is concerned?
So I spent 3 years. I'd say, like, for the most part, the first 2 years were, like, exclusively research, and the last year it was writing. It wasn't as hard and fast as that. But, like, you know, I think that what you get from that is the importance of the research. I think that what you would like for the situation to be is where the writing is the easiest part of the book, where you do the research and also outline and conceptualize it. You know, my number one advice to aspiring writers would be to speak with the people themselves. Like, there's a lot of video game history out there that was just copy and pasted from other places. And also, I think part of like that Game of Thrones analogy is because two people don't see the same incident the same way. And I don't know that you could say that there was one true version. I mean, it's not even a factual thing, but if it's like in terms of emotion, like, oh, Sonny was bitter. Oh, no, Sonny was happy. But like, I think that you should try to get the synthesis of all that from different perspectives. And, you know, I also would offer for anybody who's looking to write a book or any sort of journalism about the video game industry to reach out and contact me. I'm very supportive of that because I think that it's sad that there was not a video game history section in the bookstore. And one thing that always struck me was, like, by the time that I had a book proposal ready to go, which was like a 90-page overview of the story with like sample chapters, and you know, you could see what the book was. At that point, Seth Rogen, Evan Goldberg, and Scott Reardon were already on board for the documentary and the feature film. So this is like a pretty good package, even if you think that I'm a terrible writer. You know, like there's a lot here. It's a story that people, Sega, Nintendo, think two names that we recognize, and then also a lot of famous people involved, and Blake's not one of them. And still, 22 of 25 publishers passed on the book because they said video game books don't sell. And I was like, the reason I'm writing this is because there are no video game books, or there's so few. So I hope that for the next person, it's easier for them. And in addition to the success of Console Wars doing that, I'm also personally willing, if you contact me on Twitter or online or anywhere, to help anyone who's looking to do something similar.
Did you want to mention the other documentary? I don't know if you
And so, you know, in the course of Console Wars, we thought that, you know, Leonard Herman, who wrote a book.
Leonard's a friend of ours.
Yeah, he's friend of the guys.
A regular at Digital Press.
He's a regular here, and he was a friend. He was very nice to me, and he introduced me to Ralph Baer, who invented television games and invented video games, and which a lot of people didn't know until about 10 years ago or so. But anyway, I went up to New Hampshire to meet with Ralph, along with Jonah Tullis, my business partner and co-director, because we were mostly just wanted to meet him. Also, I think, like, kind of, like, kiss the ring a little bit. Like, hey, we're making this. I'm writing a book. We're making a documentary. You created all this. We owe you the respect of, like, saying hi, telling you what we're all about. And we were so fascinated by him, living alone in New Hampshire. He was 91 at the time. He passed away earlier this year. But we spent, we went up there for several trips to shoot a separate documentary just about him, that was, like, 50% meant to be, like, talking head interview with him, just talking about his history, you know, growing up in Germany, coming to America, fighting against the Germans in the war, getting into defense, getting into engineering, and eventually coming at video games, but also just him being 91 and living alone. He reminded us a lot of like Larry David, where he was just like, ah, this, like, I don't want to do this, and like he's just a very funny, quirky guy. And so that's something that we're working on. It obviously hasn't been a priority because the book and then the other documentary that we're already, you know, committed to seeing that through to the end. But it's something that we're going to be putting together shortly. And Ralph was just an exceptional guy. The one thing that I would want to mention from that is just like, you know, he believes, and I think rightly so, that Nolan Bushnell stole a lot of his thunder and took credit for things that he didn't do. And I don't even know that I would say that Nolan Bushnell lied about things, but he definitely let certain impressions exist and had like a persona that didn't really credit Ralph. And what I liked about Ralph was that he gives Nolan credit. He thinks like, he said Nolan was a great showman. Nolan did a lot for the video game business. He helped popularize it. He definitely, you know, Pong was catchy. It had the sound. It was, you know, he gives credit to Nolan where he thinks the credit is due, but Nolan has never like responded to any requests from Ralph, had never responded to speak with him. And I just thought that was kind of unfortunate that it wasn't like Ralph was going after this guy who such a jerk and stole my career. He seemed to have like a very reasonable and admirable.
Well, I think it'd be very valuable. I mean, I'm thinking back, and he may have been, Ralph may have been interviewed in one of those G4 Tech TV Icon episodes 10 years ago or so. But other than that, I mean, he really hasn't, there's not much of him.
Yeah, like, and the good thing with Ralph is, like, we talked about
Bushnell's in every single documentary that has anything to do with video games.
Like the date thing we talked about, so many archive documents never were saved at these video game companies, whether it's the release date of Mario or anything like that. Like, even when I did some work for Sega before, while writing this book, and like I was asking for archive materials of Sonic, and they just don't have that much. They didn't save very much. But Ralph, with his German background and just the way he was, everything is
in the book, right?
Everything has the dates. Like, I can tell you the exact time that this thing happened. So that's one nice thing about kind of getting into his world, is that, like, if he didn't have that stuff, then he would have had no defense against Nolan to say, like, actually, you saw a copy of my electronic tennis game the day that you invented Pong. Like, he had, like, the signature book from Burlingame. And
wow.
So, good on Ralph to, like, keep all those things.
And record-keeping.
Yeah, record-keeping. That's a good advice for a young writer.
And that you meant, now that he mentioned it, I do think that they should cast Larry David as Israel. That would be brilliant.
Good call.
And like have like Nolan Bushnell like unveil Pong, and then have him turn and it starts playing the Curb Your Enthusiasm theme.
How about Jeff Garland as Nolan Bushnell?
Oh, that would be brilliant.
I invented it first. I don't say anything else you wanted to mention that you're working on?
No, I'm good.
Right. What's next for you?
Just asked
in the world of console wars.
Oh, well, I sold a new book proposal to HarperCollins, who published Console Wars, and so the next book I'm writing will be about virtual reality and augmented reality and kind of the ongoing
where we're going
business gaming battle between Oculus and Microsoft and Magic Leap and all these players. And it'll be interesting to write a story that is happening as opposed to one that was 20 years ago.
In which, even though it's happening, the reality is that 99.999% of the general public have no idea that it's
going on. Actually why I wanted to write it, because like one of my pitches when I was speaking with the Oculus guys was, you know, when this comes out, the first consumer product comes out in the first quarter of 2016, like, you know, they were heavily influenced, and it speaks to the crowd that likes that Ready Player One book. I said, you know, Player One is going to be ready for this. They're going to be psyched. But Players 2 through Mom are going to be like, this is sci-fi. This is Star Trek. I don't want anything to do with this. So I want to put a human
face
on it.
I'm not buying it. There's going to be a better one 2 months later.
Yeah. So I think it's important for people to realize that, you know, this technology didn't just come out of thin air, that there's people behind this, and that there's actual, like, motivations that are not just to make money, that they want to be able to accomplish things, whether it's in education or medicine or just connecting and socially feeling like you have friends. Like, there are applications to this, and you know, they could buy it or not buy it, but I at least want to make sure people.
Now, have you thought about talking to Stephen King for this book?
Stephen King.
Because of the Lawnmower Man.
Oh.
I think he's divorced himself from that that product.
Probably should have.
Film product. Even though, you know, even though Jeff Fahey was awesome.
Jeff Fahey.
Cinema idol. And Pierce Brosnan.
Yes. Awesome. Good cast. That was where it ended.
So. Well. Unless anybody else has any other questions, I believe this closes this chapter on the console war.
Once again, thanks for coming.
Thanks, guys, for having me. This was really fun.
Awesome. Please, buy Console Wars and support the film, both the documentary version and the Seth Rogen version when that happens. So,
I want to have Seth Rogen on this show now.
We will.
When this comes out.
Make that happen.
Good luck. Man. I will try my best, but it's not going to happen.
We don't smoke.
He's so
busy. Catch you guys next time.
All right.